Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. December 31st, 2020. My thoughts on Twitter December 31st, 2020. 2021, it's becoming obvious that there's work only for some people. The rest have to build a new society, out of themselves. This means that teaching this and forming new people and relationships out of ourselves, this is the most important thing that will happen, starting this year. My new article on LinkedIn: How to Make 2021 Our Best Year Ever. Each year on December 28th, people celebrate the good riddance day, when they toss, smash, or burn objects, pictures, or notes representing bad memories from the previous year. This year, the event, inspired by a Latin American tradition, was especially noticeable as people lined up in Times Square to smash their bad memories. After all, didn't 2020 provide much to toss and smash? I understand why people want to smash bad memories and why they hope they will never return. But I also know that smashing bad memories, that is, putting them behind us, and forgetting about them, is the best way to guarantee that they will return, and likely more intensely than before. We treat unpleasant events as misfortunes, but they are not. If there is no purpose to unpleasant events, however painful, then is there a purpose to the welcome events, those that please us, and make us feel good? If something makes no sense, how can its opposite make any sense? What has emerged in the passing year, especially in the US, is hatred, mainly between left and right. If they could overcome it, they would thrive in everything: health, education, economics, and in every other sense. What is destroying America is hatred between left and right, and between blacks and whites. Revealing the hatred in itself is not bad. What's bad is when you don't do anything about it. Hatred among people is revealed, so we will rise above it. However hard we try to stifle it, it will not work. Americans have been trying to suppress hatred between blacks and whites probably since the beginning of slavery. They fought a civil war over racial hatred, yet racism is as vivid and as rabid now as it has always been. Moreover, now it is destroying the entire American society. This should teach us something. We cannot erase hatred, we can only rise above it. That is, we can only increase our desire to unite, our understanding that unity is essential to our survival, to the point that unity precisely with the one we hate is more important than to vent our aversion. When we do that, when we make unity that important to us, we will realize that this was the whole purpose of experiencing the hatred in the first place. Had it not been for the revelation of the hatred, we would not have needed to forge such a strong union. Now, thanks to the prior animosity, we have formed unity on levels that we never knew existed. For this reason, we should not say good riddance to anything that we don't like. On the contrary, we need to look for the flaw it came to show us. And that flaw, one way or the other, will always relate to our lack of love for one another. So for the coming year, I wish everyone a year of reckoning, a year of understanding why things happen, why we should unite, and how we can achieve it. This will give 2020 purpose and meaning, and it will make 2021 our best year ever. Medium published my new article 10 Insights on 2020, and beyond. 2020 was an eventful year. Traumatic in many ways, revolutionary in others, and certainly unpredictable. As I see it, 2020 has ushered us into a new era, where we will view things very differently going forward. So, to conclude 2020, I'd like to offer some insights on several topics that were affected by this turbulent year, and some thoughts about our future in human society. 1. Familial relations. In 2020, we learned about the importance of family, that in the end, this is our first, most intimate, and most natural circle, the one I truly should look after. We've done a lot of scrutiny regarding the family, and I think that in the end, it will create more solid connections. 2. Food. This year, at least in Israel, we stopped eating out, since restaurants were closed much of the time, and started cooking. In my view, this can only do us good. I hope we can eliminate the supermarkets and leave only 10% of the things they sell, only the healthy, natural things. This is all we need. Nothing is better for us than to cook our own food. And if we crave something new, we can always visit our neighbors or they can visit us. 3. Shopping. I think shopping will change drastically. It all depends on the influence of the environment, but I don't think shopping will be as it was prior to the virus. It's just that the social environment dictates everything. If it told us to walk around in slippers, we would. If it told us that high heels were ridiculous, no woman would dare wear them. Instead of looking for new things to buy, we will look for new insights, new relationships with people. We will want to buy a new approach to everyone, more welcoming and warm. We will become ashamed when we have bad thoughts about others. We will feel as though we're walking around naked, and everyone can see who we really are, that our thoughts are exposed. The garments will be a little more spiritual, beautifying our thoughts about others rather than the skin on our flesh. 4. Health. As I said many times before, I don't view COVID-19 as an illness. I think it is a cure that heals our society, our relationships, and in the end, our health. I think that after the pandemic, society will feel healthier than it felt prior to the pandemic, especially if we use the crisis in order to intensify our connections and mutual responsibility. 5. School. I think we must revolutionize the education system, turn it upside down. There is more to be discussed here, but it's clear that the current system is defunct and needs to change. It is simply unsuitable for the 21st century. Schools have become a place for nothing but licentiousness, drugs, and a host of other corruptions. There is no point going back to it. 6. Monitors and screens. Although we are spending more time than ever watching our little screens on mobile phones or PCs, we haven't learned a thing from them. What we did learn is that the people who control the mainstream and social media are so corrupt that I haven't enough words to describe what I think about them. It is simply terrible. I would disconnect anyone who is currently creating shows on the media, and I would send them all to an institution where they can be educated about being human, if it is still possible for them. The media are not a means of communication, they are a means of manipulation. I think a radical change is necessary here, or we will all suffer a terrible blow because of it, and only afterwards begin to recover and do things better. Before people in the media even approach their job, they must be taught what it means to treat people decently. Only after they are reformed in that way can they be permitted to work in this field. 7. Jobs and careers. It turns out that we don't need to work that many hours. In 2020, we learned that we can work fewer hours, settle for more basic needs, but benefit ourselves and all of nature in the process. 8. Money. For now, we still worship money. However, we are moving toward an awakening from it, and I hope that soon we will begin to feel that there is no escape from revolutionizing how we value things. We will begin to search for new rewards, benefits that have to do with improved human relations, a sense of mutual esteem, equality, and mutual responsibility. When we can buy what we need through good relationships, money will become meaningless. 9. Living conditions. We've learned that we can live out in the country and still remain connected. This is very important. I'm sure that this trend will expand. Today, there is no reason why I shouldn't live where I feel most comfortable yet work at almost anything. 10. Travel. I think travel has changed significantly. People are losing the desire, the craving to see new things. There was a period when humanity chased these excursions, but we seem to have grown out of it. I think we're entering a period where people will simply not be able to satisfy themselves simply by traveling. Looking at buildings or nature will simply not do it for us anymore. This trend is even more potent in the younger generation. Young people are completely absorbed in their mobile phones. They may be in Amsterdam, or wherever, yet text their friends back home. What they have on the monitor is what matters, and nothing else interests them. My new article on LinkedIn 2021, a decisive year for Europe. 2021 is going to be a decisive year for Europe. The old continent has become a cesspool of divisiveness among countries, factions, movements, and peoples. The UK, Germany, France, the Balkans, Italy, Spain, everything is so divided and splintered that unless Europeans start thinking of themselves as one entity very soon, they will suffer terribly. It will certainly not be easy, but a pan-European identity is their only way out of anguish. Europe is in many ways the cradle of human development. As such, the world will look at it and learn, and Europe should show the world what the future of the world can be like. It must show that despite all the many colors, races, nationalities, and their war-ridden history, they can rise above it and build themselves as one family, truly as one family. Otherwise, they will simply consume one another. If they do not unite, I see no future for them. Besides their internal frictions, China, Russia, and the US will vie over control in Europe, and nothing will be left of the old lady. Even Africa will join the party, as is already happening with the migration of refugees, but in other ways, as well. When you look at the world map, it's interesting to see the unique role that each place has in bringing the world to a better place. The US is an example of a nation divided into myriad factions that are still one nation. Europe is an example of many nations that must function as one nation. Each must provide an example of unity above the differences that the world can follow. If either of them fails to carry out their role, they will suffer. I can't say who will suffer more if they do not execute their required union, but both will certainly agonize. Israel, too, has its unique role. In fact, Israel's role is perhaps the most important in the process of unifying the world. Israel must provide the philosophy, the theory, the ideological infrastructure for unity, where it comes from, why unity is essential, and by which rules and regulations we are to arrange it. The current European Union will not achieve these goals. In fact, I am all for dismantling it, and I'm happy that the UK left it. The current EU was not built in order to unite Europe. It was established in order to bolster banks, industrialists, and billionaires, but not to unite Europe. One could drive from one end of Europe to the other before the establishment of the EU, so there is no benefit in terms of open borders. The regular person does not gain anything from living in a so-called united Europe. As I said in the beginning, a European Union should be a union of their hearts, where they feel that they are in deep connection. And the more different they are, the more tightly they will unite, according to their efforts. The ones who are the farthest now will be the closest once they unite. This union must be completely unrelated to the existing institutions of the EU. It must be a separate entity that functions whether or not the current EU survives the approaching upheavals. This union of hearts is the union they were searching for over the past 30 years or so since they established the EU. And as for Israel and the ideology that Israel is required to provide, the level of hatred that Europeans will harbor toward Israel depends on the level of their hatred for connection. If Israel offers a way to connect, which isn't the current situation, but presumably, and the Europeans shun it because they do not want to connect, then they will have no choice but to take some more beating from other countries or from nature until they yield and become receptive to the notion of connection. And speaking of anti-Semitism, we think it is impervious to reason, and perhaps this is so, as are all hatreds. However, anti-Semitism is not impervious to a model of unity coming out of Israel. Even Henry Ford, whose anti-Semitic ideology Hitler admired, wrote in his rabid composition The International Jew, "The world's foremost problem, the emergence of the Jewish question, is a part of the culmination of destiny that has come upon us, not for harm but for good. The justification of a discussion of the Jewish question is the good for the Jews, and the greatest present obstacle to that good is the Jews themselves. The time is here when they shall see it." In other words, anti-Semitism is not necessarily a fact of life, but something that Israel can overcome by carrying out its role, and by the nations accepting Israel's contribution, the ideology of unity. The future of Europe hangs in the balance. If Europeans overcome their divisions soon, they will triumph. If not, they will lose bitterly. Israel, for its part, must do its duty in the healing by providing the ideology of unity above differences and by setting an example. My new article on LinkedIn, Wake Up Humanity, Before the Waves Drown Us. Most of the summaries of 2020, the few who even attempted it, speak of 2020 as a tragedy, as if their lives have been stolen. In my view, this is an immature perspective. When a little boy plays outside with his friends and his mother calls him in to finish his homework, the boy thinks she is a terrible mother, but we grown-ups know better. We are like that boy, throwing a temper tantrum at Mother Nature's insistence that we do what we must. Nature didn't do anything bad to humanity, she only called us in to do our homework. And as we all know, if we don't do our homework, we will fail the test. And when the test is about our lives, it is not one we want to fail. While we were home, in the first lockdown that Mother Nature imposed on us, we should have started doing our homework. We should have realized that she had sent us, the virus that sent us, home only because we have been bad to one another, like brothers who cannot get along and fight so much that their mother has no choice but to send them to their separate rooms. She hopes that after some time alone, they will realize that they shouldn't treat each other as they did and will resolve to find a way to get along. After some time, the mother lets them out, since she is their mother, after all, and wants them to enjoy life. However, instead of making peace, they start fighting even worse than before. The poor mother has no choice but to punish them more severely, hoping that this time they will learn. The children know that when they are quiet, mother is nice to them. But the brothers hate each other so fiercely that they forget what is best for them the minute they see each other, so they start bickering again. This is where we are. Nature's blows are like the mother's admonition or punishment, and we are the obstinate children. Instead of learning, we're counting on the vaccines to enable us to take off our masks so we can swear at each other once again, eliminate the social distance so we can beat each other up, and hail this emotional carnage as freedom and normalcy. Every time nature sends another punishment, it's like a wave that hits us and forces us to retreat. During the retreat, we are supposed to reflect on our behavior with each other. But we don't. Finally, the water recedes and we come out of our shelters only to squabble, humiliate, and exploit each other even more than before. This makes the next wave more substantial, aiming to force us to reflect. If we don't start reflecting soon, the waves will drown us. They might come in all sorts of ways. Nature is very creative when it comes to punishments, but there is no reason for us to experience them firsthand. We can choose instead to discover her creativity in giving and in caring. Look at the coronavirus. We haven't even vaccinated everyone from the original strain, and we are already dealing with two new strains, from the UK and from South Africa, both of which are much more contagious, and to which we don't know if the vaccine already approved will work. It is a sign that nature will not let up. She will not stop until we learn. Look at how we're treating one another with the vaccine. Why do countries that cannot afford to buy it have to beg for it? Haven't we learned that we are all in this together? Haven't we seen that an infection anywhere is an infection everywhere? Dispensing the vaccine to all the countries, none excluded, is our first test in mutual responsibility. So far, we're failing. As I see things now, I think that we will live with the coronavirus and its mutations for many years to come. It's come to teach us to live differently, with more care, consideration, and responsibility for one another. Until we learn, it won't go away. The waves will come and go, but the more we stall in learning, the more poignant the waves will become. In the beginning, the virus didn't affect children, now it does. In the beginning, it affected mainly our lungs, now it affects our brains and hearts. What more do we want it to do to us, before we learn what it is trying to tell us? Remember the mother allegory, if we don't stop fighting, Mother Nature will send us to our separate rooms or find other ways to punish us, which will be more and more painful. The energy that feeds us. Question: a person is part of a large complex system. Naturally, we need internal energy and strength to maintain systemic relations. What is the energy source that feeds us? Answer: this is egoistic fulfillment on all levels, inanimate, vegetative, animate, and human. If we want to get to the next level, then we need to use this energy to nourish our bodies only to the extent necessary for their existence, and we fill our eye with the quality of bestowal and love for others. Then, we will begin to receive a new kind of fulfillment, filling with bestowal. This will be a completely different feeling of awareness of existence. Question: so, in fact, a person can simultaneously receive two types of energy? Answer: yes. I get an animal filling for my body and absolutely consciously because my condition dictates this to me. The highest fulfillment is where I work in a completely different way, in the quality of bestowal and love for others. Question: why does a person sometimes lack energy? Answer: he does not see its source and does not know why to receive it and how to use it correctly. Therefore, the states of powerlessness, aimlessness, detachment, and nihilism are good states that lead him to a correct re-evaluation of one's values both within oneself and in the world, and then lead a person to the next stage. Comment: from the point of view of the system's approach, our lack of energy is not very good for the system because a person begins to become imbalanced within it. My response: this pushes him forward in his search. In this search, he finds himself in new states. If he did not have that need, he would never have developed. As they say, love and hunger rule the world. Question: how can one be happy and fulfilled in any given situation? Answer: this depends on the goal. If it approaches you even with a sense of some unpleasant qualities, feelings, and actions, this does not matter. The main thing is that, in the end, you get something more. It all depends on the value of what you are aiming for. From Cab TV's Kabbalah Express, December 7, 2020. Concealment teaches us how to correct ourselves. We are in a special reality that entirely hides the Creator. But if we relate to it correctly, then through all its levels, inanimate, vegetative, animate, and human, we gradually find out that the Creator wants us to reveal Him. This concealment teaches us how to correct ourselves in order to reveal the Creator, not to remain in blind faith, but to attain the upper force explicitly and openly, to come from concealment to revelation. Therefore, we must perceive this world as an opportunity to reveal the Creator. Behind the material world, we will begin to reveal the spiritual world, its many stages, and each time rise from concealment to revelation. Through such exercises, organized by the Creator from the beginning of creation to the end, we gain reason and sensations, learn how the Creator hides and how to reveal Him, and through concealment and revelation we understand what he wants to tell us. It is known that the advantage of light is perceived from darkness, but darkness is the first attainment. Only within it do we begin to reveal the light and the Creator, learn his language, the letters, a point, a line, a circle, a triangle, a crossbar, different forms of darkness and light, revealed one against the other. In this way, we gradually gain understanding and start to speak with the Creator in the same language, to master his program, according to which we must build ourselves in order to understand him, feel and become his partners, sons in the entire universe, in all forms of his concealment and revelation. In the end, all concealments only support revelation. The concealment does not disappear, but becomes a background on which we reveal the upper force and incorporate the darkness and light in ourselves and reach our end of correction. Concealment is perceived against the background of revelation, and revelation against the background of concealment. The main thing is to be in both states and be able to move from one to the other and back on your own, and so begin to understand the Creator's message, his language, and know what he wants to tell us. The whole creation consists of two forces, plus and minus, light and darkness, which manifest themselves in relation to us, as concealment and revelation. That is why it is so important in every state we go through, every day and every moment, not to turn away from the situation in order to see that it has the measure of concealment, and the measure of revelation in it. The main thing is not to forget that we stand directly in front of the Creator, who always draws us, a world woven of concealment and revelation. As if writing black letters on a white sheet of paper, the Creator reveals to us his attitude, his nature, so that we study him, learn to understand, cooperate, and so achieve adhesion with him. All our lives, in any situation, we must remember that we are present with some concealment and some revelation of the Creator, and by combining these two forms, he draws the world and our sense of ourselves for us. Then we will know the right way to turn deeper inside to him, to feel not ourselves in our world, but the Creator, that is, how he builds us, and our world. From the first part of the Daily Kabbalah Lesson, December 29, 2020, Concealment. New Life 1290. Motivation at Work.
Shalom lachem, toda shetem mitzarfim.
Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. We are here in New Life, a series of programs with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, and hello, this is show number 1290. We'll present the situation to Rav and ask Rav how to deal with it in this new integral life. Yael. We're talking about an organization. It used to be a small organization, a small number of excited employees wanted to develop it and succeed. The company grew. Today it's 100, has 100 people. There's a mechanism of managers and CEO, CFO, HR, all that. And the excitement of the employees has dropped a little bit. Everybody got into a sort of a routine. When management is now sitting in a meeting and wanted to excite that original excitement that employees had in order to develop new ideas and bring in new spirit to the organization. We would like to look during the conversation both at the organization and at the employees. So the question facing the management is how to rekindle this motivation in the employees, and also we'll ask how can the employees awaken motivation for themselves. And I want to ask, can motivation even remain over a long period of time? Rav, no. Why? Rav, because motivation, where you have an awakening and an upliftment, a renewal from the person. And the person is a desire to enjoy, to rest, a desire for vacation, for leisure, and not only for work, 15 hours a day, including commuting and all that. So we can't demand of him to constantly be in a state of, you know, motivation, have this motive power and desire to be at work. So I don't see the possibility of sowing in an employee such a constant awakening that will open him and excite him from within. Rather, it depends on the organization, but you have to keep a number of people whose specialty it is to awaken the employees, who will have this awakening and this renewed desire to work. So we'll get back to it. Then I want to ask, what causes the a decrease of motivation? Rav, this is our nature. We can do it. It's like you start to eat something very tasty and you enjoy the food and everything, and then after a while you're not moving so quickly with the dish. Maybe you take a break a little more, but eventually you leave it. Why? Tell me why. How much appetite, how much hunger, how much can you do it? Yeah, I want to look from the side of the employee. We would like to come with a great excitement to work. It makes the day different. It gives you a good feeling. Rav, it's only on the condition that you yourself generate the work and arrange it. You're included in the process. You express in the process your own desire, vision for the future or something. But if you work for in a daily routine of sorts, then of course there's nothing that can keep you excited. Yeah, I want to get back to what you just said. What needs to happen so as an employee I will remain excited over time? I will feel that interested. I will feel desire to develop at work. Also here, those who work for a salary, there are those who work because something is interesting to them. There are those who work because if they work because otherwise they get thrown out of work, and so on and so forth. I mean, you can't have the same vision for the future, the same stimulus for everyone. That's what I'm saying. We need to have a few people in this company that are concerned with awakening, igniting the excitement among the workers. Should I put it? Out of a desire, a yearning, a burning fire that is theirs. Is there something that I, as an employee, can do for myself? Because it's the organization's interest, but it's also my own interest to keep that motivation. Rob, yeah? You can tell yourself that if you don't do well, you won't get a raise, or maybe you'll lose your job. Or if these are not financial matters, then maybe it's something else that is worthwhile for you to find an attractive component about this job, something that belongs to the profession, to the craft. So in this way you will tie yourself to what you're doing and enjoy the process itself. What do I have to tie myself to so it will give me continuous pleasure? Rav, you have to find pleasure in the work itself. That's it. So it's like even a cobbler. If he doesn't derive pleasure from making these shoes in a certain way, he's not a craftsman, a master. And what is this component of the craft you mentioned, Rav? He enjoys the pleasure itself, not the end goal, definitely not the money, but the process itself. He's doing this work, he enjoys it. He works and sings. Or what does it depend on to feel that I work and I sing and I enjoy the process, Rav? The extent to which he appreciates his craftsmanship in the work. Again, it could be a cobbler, a mason, it doesn't matter what he does. But he enjoys that thing that he does in a complete, whole manner. It depends on his choice, what does he choose to do, or it depends on the daily routine. Rav, no, that's nothing to do with routine. He sees in every action that he performs a form of art, a craftsmanship. There has to be renewal in each action. Rav, yes, that's how he sees it. I got it. So what makes motivation disappear? And tell us, what causes the disappearance of motivation and what causes the awakening of motivation? Rob, if he does not stimulate himself, excite himself, ignite himself, doesn't talk to himself that he is an artist, that he does something beautiful, he enjoys what he's doing, a certain part of the work, let alone when he completes it, then he's not a craftsman. He's simply a poor laborer who carries himself from morning to night. Can anyone awaken himself for this? Rav, it depends on education, on people that work next to him. That's why I said you might want to have people who are in charge of this at the workplace, whose job it is to provide a certain fire that will burn in the factory or the office. Or if you would be on a team of such people whose job it is in the organization to awaken, rekindle the fire of motivation in the organization. You have an organization with 100 people. What is the first action that you take upon yourself to increase motivation? What is the first action of this team, Rob? There isn't a single unified answer across the board. Rather, I would show them how people work in similar places in Israel and abroad. Is there anything else there? Can we do it in a way that will feel special? I would create some form of a contest between them, a competition. I would add rewards, not necessarily monetary rewards, but reward the attitude to the work, the artistic attitude towards the work. There are many things. I'm not an expert on it. I'm just saying this is something you need to have. I'm speaking about it because I know human nature, not because I'm an expert in creating the positive contest in the workplace. And not only the contest aspect. It's possible that even with a person who works alone, and no one is overseeing his work, but he loves the job, and even the job that he does daily, a routine in which he does not have anything new, but he still finds in it, how should I put it? It feels good to him, to his soul, to do it. Yeah, if I look at various recommendations that we see, in this area, and then they talk about establishing goals. What do I get out of these goals? Prepare a plan, imagine the result, remind myself why am I doing it, keep a positive attitude, encourage myself in this situation. Is it the correct attitude in your eyes? Is the focus of the scrutiny my connection, my relationship to all these components? Either way, I'm not saying something concrete. Either way, you have to see how you can add a level of interest to people, the ability to renew things. You have to make these people partners, not necessarily financially, but partners in what we're doing. And feel that everything depends on them. And why? So they would see the quality of the work influences them, and for them to see, to receive a desire to create. Yeah, you said several interesting things. You talked about renewal, awakening, creativity has to fit a person's soul. A person has to get to know himself, what awakens him, and he has to reignite that inside of him. And you also spoke about the place of partnership and being partners with your organization. I want to focus on the partnership. What kind of partnership there needs to be between the organization and the worker? Rob, the worker needs to feel that he is a partner to what's happening in the organization. In his correct partnership, everybody benefits, the organization and as well as him. It doesn't have to be a financial partnership. It could be he can be gaining respect, appreciation, many things. So you're speaking about certain reward for what he's doing. But should there be a certain partnership between him and the organization? Right. Maybe, yes. Again, these things have to be weighed inside the organization. What is the nature of the organization? Where it is? What country? What's the atmosphere it's all done in? I can speak generally about those things. Oh, and I want to focus on one aspect we didn't see yet. We're talking about how to raise motivation. Say I'm one of 100 people. It doesn't matter if I'm a mid-level manager or a worker, and I want my motivation to grow. What is the influence of the quality of the connection with the people around me? It might be my colleagues, my managers, my subordinates, depending where I'm in the hierarchy. But tell me, first, generally speaking, to what extent the quality of the connection between me and others influence my motivation as an individual? Rough, of course it influences. Or a lot, a little, rough. A great deal. It depends on the atmosphere I have, what relationship I have with them. How the workplace is organized in general, the general atmosphere, the individual atmosphere. There are many parameters in this. I can't get into it, but as far as I know, and I'm not working in this area, there's a whole science to it. Warren, you said something earlier, very special. So, the most important is for a person to find something that feels good to his soul in what he's doing. And you can find it even in the most mundane things. And I immediately got questions from my viewers. How can you feel that some routine work does good to your soul, Rav? That depends on the character of a person. I have an acquaintance, and his job is, he works at a bank. The simplest job. It's called filing. You know what it is, right? Yeah, he files documents from morning till evening. Rav, that's it. He enjoys it. I was surprised to hear it, because by his nature, he loves order. If he comes to your house, he will rearrange the plates and the forks, and he can even rearrange your closet. I'm not saying that he has a condition, but he has something of that, more than a normal or an average person. And he found this work, this filing job, and he enjoys, he loves it. So it turns out that not only he loves the order, but here it's hard to distinguish what's more. Maybe he calms himself down by this work. He sees that there's a great deal of mess. I used to have a cleaning person. What mess. She looks at the place she has to clean, and she derives pleasure from its state of shambles. And then she starts to work, and then an hour or two later, you'll see everything is clean, it's polished, it's sparkling. I see, according to your worldview, that there is no person and there's no engagement in which you can't find pleasure, inner satisfaction that keeps me calm and gives me a drive to continue doing it. But it has to be with a person from birth. A tendency for it, Ravi, either for order or cleanliness or something. Or, meaning that has to be a natural tendency. But other than that, you describe how a person arranges himself relative to his work. So I want to focus not on the natural tendency, not even on this specific example. I want to take a person who finds himself, let's say that generally fits his type of tendency. He can have a low level of motivation or a high level of motivation. What is the most important principle he can teach me in order to raise my level of motivation? What do I need to tell myself? Well, first of all, that your job is very important. You're going to receive appreciation from many people. They're going to look at you and refer to you like to an expert. When you come home, before you go to bed, you'll get a phone call from someone who thanks you for doing this work, and thanks to you, he found a document that did something. In short, you feel that people appreciate you. There are many exercises for it. And I see this, the word appreciation, I see has two directions. The first direction is that I myself would appreciate what I'm doing, and the second vector is that those around me will appreciate what I do.
Yeah.
So the first thing, for me to appreciate what I do, if I understand you correctly, in everything I do, I can appreciate myself and grow my motivation from that. Meaning, motivation is in my hands. I can manage it like an instrument. Maybe you enjoy the order, or as we said, like a profession, and then you'll do it, and that belongs to your nature. Now, we are different people. Each has his own nature. I have my own nature, you have your own nature, Yael has her own nature. But we live in a human system. Nature made everyone special. If I want to look at in an integral view at their organization or a family, wherever there's more than one person and they're integrated in some way, what is the integral principle of the individual in the system? system that can increase the motivation of the individual to feel he's part of a system, that he contributes to it. How should he look, using which integral glasses do I need to look at myself as an individual in the system? Well, first of all, you are in the center of attention, to some extent. Hold on, it's nice. I'm in the center. Yeah, even if you're have a filing job or you're a janitor, it doesn't matter. Each and every person, no matter what he's doing, can feel himself that he's doing an important job. Now, if the cleaning person doesn't clean up the office, you won't be able to find anything there. So that's how I need to look at myself, that in this system I'm in the center, Rav, yeah. And where's my integration with others? You're doing everything so they would succeed in their job. Through your work, you're helping them accomplish it. And each and everyone in the company is doing the same. Yeah. So if we look at from the side of the organization, I, as a worker, need to feel that whatever I do is significant, contributes to the organization and to people around me. And from the side of the organization, what should be the motivation consultant? What should he generate in the organization? Well, that's a different job. The consultant needs to see how he arranges relationship between employees, between the workers. When you have levels and hours of work, and that's a different thing altogether. I'll ask a question from the side of the consultant about competition. You said those consultants will come and increase motivation. They can use the instrument of competition, contest, but in a special way. You had a recommendation and also a caveat. So what kind of contest should I evoke and what should not? What is an integral competition that will increase everyone's motivation and not only to the winning party? Rav, when we wish to reach a certain special success, unusual success in the work of the organization, you can't stretch it forever, but only for a certain period of time. And the workers need to know that the success we put before us as a goal, by reaching it, we come to a certain special goal and rewards. Oh, and when does competition begin to be destructive? Rob, I'm not for competition in general, and not inside the organization, the office. Why? Because then you're aiming the employee to not to work and succeed, but to succeed by destroying the other. It's always like that, Rav. It's clear. So not to use competition as an instrument for increasing motivation? No, it's a bad competition. Is there a good competition? Rav, no, I'm for an integral competition. We're all competing with ourselves in order to connect with others and reach a general result. So that expert needs to know how to connect me to a competition with myself. Yes, and that connects to what you said at the beginning of the meeting on how a person awakens himself. If a person awakens himself to a competition with himself, will that help? Well, yeah, that might help. But again, I'm for awakening people to using good motivation, positive motivation, not negative one. We have to conclude shortly, sadly. Let's finish with this definition. How do you define good motivation, positive motivation, rather than negative motivation? Rav, it's when we wish to awaken the expert in a person, the craftsman in an expert, the artist, that what he does He loves the order. He loves the work itself. He loves the process of work. He doesn't care so much about finishing quickly and getting a salary and forget about it and go home and go to a bar and get a drink. Rather, he derives pleasure from these hours that he invests in this work, his craft. We need to bring people to a state where, just like an artist who sculpts a sculpture or paints a picture, enjoys every he paints and he looks, this is beautiful and pretty and this is not, and more or less, this for him is pleasure, is life. He has painting in his blood. And it doesn't care that he's doing it faster than another or something. He needs to look at the work. On the other hand, that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we're nevertheless talking about a workplace. It's an industry. And then we need to use art as a single component in it. That gives us, produces a better quality of work, but not necessarily the product of the work, the quantity. For that, we need to have a certain competition, but we have to talk about the competition has to be not between offices, or definitely not within the office, but between factories, something wider that doesn't, it's not going to stick me in the eyes. Rav Lechman, we would ask 1,000 more questions. It's fascinating, but our time is out. Thank you. Until next time, Rav, for now, succeed in this way. Thank you, Yael. Thank you, everyone. Chaim Chadashim, new life.
Does the concept of life change over time? Question. Recently, when, on one hand, the world is being hit by a pandemic and other crises and, on the other hand, there are very strong developments in technology and science, does this mean that the very concept of life is changing? Answer, it is changing. Ordinary people living in this world are beginning to feel more and more that this world does not have any meaning, that none of our efforts will lead us to something special, that is, to eternal fulfillment, and, therefore, that there is really no need to live. This is awakening, especially in the new generation. The next generations are coming who will fully feel the hopelessness and aimlessness of our existence. This will lead the masses to the question of the meaning of life. We must prepare this transition for them. From Cab TV's Kabbalah Express, December 7th, 2020. The mythological language of the Book of Zohar. There are texts in the Book of Zohar that seem very strange to an ordinary person. Therefore, to introduce a person into them, to explain them to him, it will take, perhaps, several years. It all depends on the qualities and states that one must experience in order to begin to feel them. Just like a small child, you cannot tell about the experiences of an adult, about his art, etc. He will not understand this. The allegorical, mythological language of the Book of Zohar is very conventional, but accurate. After all, if I know the inner meaning of the concept crocodile, then through the image of an earthly crocodile, I see the forces that stand behind it, determine its general background, properties, appearance, character, absolutely everything. I see all spiritual properties in this earthly image, and I deal with them. Thus, the book of Zohar tells about our inner properties. Through reading it, I reveal everything in myself. The Garden of Eden is the highest level. The four rivers, the crocodile, the big sea, this is Malkut in which souls exist, and with them I must merge. That is, this whole picture is in me. Everything exists in the person himself. Even the world that is supposedly around us, in fact, we feel what is inside ourselves. It only seems to us that it is on the outside. From Cab TV's The Power of the Book of Zohar, 1. Will we return to this world after death? Question: will a person return to this world after death? Answer: if we talk only about the animal, physical, body and its life, then this state does not return. There is no need for it and there is nothing to regret about it. We just need to try to extract the maximum eternal benefit from each state that we go through. Question: if we do not speak from the point of view of the animal body, but from the point of view of human consciousness, what does life and death look like? Answer: a person's consciousness should lead him to a state where he begins to feel the general consciousness, connects to the general cloud of information and fulfillment and stays in it. He will see himself and everything that exists in a single stream of information. Question: can a person remember his past incarnations? Answer: if in order to realize himself, a person needs some new or additional information, then he receives this from being included in this huge cloud, which is called the Creator, Nature. From Cab TV's Kabbalah Express, December 7th, 2020. Blitz of Kabbalah tips about love. Question: what does love of life mean to you? Answer: love of life is an opportunity to achieve what I really strive for. Question: what is eternal love? Answer: eternal love is a state of absolute fulfillment, which does not entail any opportunities to add something. Question: what is absolute love? Answer: the same. Question: first love? Answer: it is just a youthful hobby that lyricists invented. Question: love without borders? Answer: here we mean, probably, eternal, perfect love. Question: love for the family? Answer: this kind of love arises because there are people I must take care of. Question: what does love of friends mean to you? Answer: friends, comrades, this is the small circle of people with whom I wish to climb to the top of life. Question: love for the teacher? Answer: a teacher is a guide that shows me how to develop my soul and make myself immortal. Question: love for your neighbor? Answer: all people on earth are neighbors. They are parts of our common soul, Adam. Question: love for yourself? Answer: self-love is selfish love over which one must rise as quickly as possible. Question: love for the Creator, what is it? Answer: love for the Creator is love for the entire universe, which is permeated with the property of reciprocity and convergence. From Cab TV's Communication Skills, October 23, 2020. If everyone lived by the rules. Question: do I need to explain the norms of behavior to an adult, or would this be considered interfering in someone else's life? Answer: there is no such thing as someone else's life. We are all elements of the same system and we all influence each other. Therefore, a person does not have absolute freedom in relation to others. He must take his rightful part in the general system in which he was born and in which he lives. He cannot free himself from this in any way, not even through death. Question: if everyone lived by the rules, would we all be happy? Answer: to the fullest. From Cab TV's Communication Skills, October 9, 2020. Seeing the highest impact in everything. Question: are all problems sent to us by the Creator? Answer: These are not problems but impacts on me. Only I, perhaps, misunderstand them and therefore consider them to be unnecessary and harmful. I must understand that everything comes from the Creator so that I correctly tune into Him with a correct, reverse connection. Question: does this mean that a Kabbalist believes that any disturbance, for example, an illness, can be regarded as the positive influence of the Creator that is capable of moving him forward? Answer: surely. Everything that the Creator does is aimed at bringing each of us, and everyone together to Him. This is so that the whole environment, including the inanimate, vegetative, animate, and people, would not be some kind of obstacle preventing me from getting closer to Him. One should accustom oneself to seeing only an example of His highest influence in everything and to try to react to it in the same way in return. The method of how to see the one single force behind everything is the science of Kabbalah. From Kab TV's Spiritual States, February 4, 2019.